make his presentation based on Srimad Bhagavatam. He's also going to explain here in 27 and 28, before he starts actually making his presentation about that truth, and as we said, that will be in text 29. So let us read then, first of all, text 27. 27 part 1. Therefore, to ascertain what is actually the highest good in life, we should focus our investigation on Srimad Bhagavatam, carefully reconciling its statements with what precedes and follows them. With this aim, in this work consisting of 6 sandarbhas, the introductory sentences in each anuchet, or text we call them, will serve the function of sutras. The quotations from Srimad Bhagavatam will be the scriptural texts under consideration. Sridhar Swami's explanation of the Bhagavatam will serve as our primary commentary. Srila Sridhar Swami is a perfect Vaishnava, but to entice the Advaitavadis, nowadays prominent all over Madhya Desh and other parts of the country, to become absorbed in the glories of the Supreme Lord, he mixed some traces of their theories into his writings. We will cite Sri Swami Charan's commentary verbatim when it agrees with the conclusions of pure Vaishnava philosophy. And 27, part 2. Our explanation of certain Bhagavatam verses will be based on comments given by Sridhar Swami on other verses. Sometimes, our explanation will be based on statements by the exalted devotees of the Lord, known as Sri Vaishnavas. They're famous throughout the Dravidadesh, South India, and in other regions, and their sampradaya was founded by the goddess Sri herself. Srimad Bhagavatam attests to the greatness of these devotees, affirming their numerical strength in South India and their reputation as Vaishnavas. So he quotes then from Srimad Bhagavatam, in Kali Yuga, there are indeed Vaishnavas scattered here and there, but they are especially abundant in the Dravida regions, 11.5.39. The statements of the Sri Vaishnavas we cite are certified by the authority of Sri Ramanuja Bhagavatpad's opinions, found in his Sri Bhasya and other works written by him. Sometimes, we'll simply follow the self-evident meaning of the original Bhagavatam texts, and sometimes, we'll base our explanations on other authorities. Since the explanations of the Advaitavadis are already so well known, we will not bother to elaborate on them much. In other words, we are not interested in the Mayavadis. Yes, okay, so that is text 27. And there are some interesting points there. So, 27.1. Certainly, the focus obviously has to be on Srimad Bhagavatam. And he explains how he's going to present the message of, or the verses of Srimad Bhagavatam, which he's going to quote. Many, many verses from Srimad Bhagavatam. So he says he will... reconcile the statements. He'll take the verses and points they make, not, you know, like independent, not independent of the context in which they appear. It'll be a very contextually based presentation. He is not just going to take a verse and say, look, Srimad Bhagavatam says this, but he is going to present the statements in terms of, first of all, the systematic intent of the whole book, what the whole book is about. Then, the verses, when he quotes verses, he'll also take into consideration the immediate context, the verses immediately surrounding that verse, and even on a more extended basis, some number of verses, different passages, which the particular verse or verses that he's referring to, which they appear in. So like this, it's going to be a very honest presentation and a very thorough presentation, taking into consideration these important factors, not just arbitrarily taking one quote from here, one quote from there, but taking into consideration the contexts, both in the complete sense of the whole Bhagavatam and the more local sense of where the particular verses are appearing. So then he goes on to say how he will present his arguments. He's going to use a system. So this is also there in 27.1. He says, of course, he's talking about all the six sandarbhas. It's not just tattva sandarbha. In fact, in many cases, it's more in the other sandarbhas, although it's also there in tattva sandarbha. But this is his general system for making his points. First of all, this is something like Vedanta Sutra, actually. It's not unrelated. It's not exactly the same. But it's not unrelated. It's a three-step process. The first step, he says, is that with this aim, in this work consisting of six sandarbhas, the introductory sentences in each anuchet, in each text, will serve the function of sutras. So what this means is that he will begin each text with something like a general statement. A statement that something is like something. For example, in Vedanta Sutra, the very first anuchet, or what do they call it there? Anukaran, something like that. The very first anukaran, very first text, begins with a famous statement. Do you know what that is, that statement? Atato brahma jigyasa. Now is the time to inquire into the absolute truth. Yeah. So that is not really an argument. It's just a statement. Here we are. This is this. So this is what he's saying here. The introductory sentence will serve the function of a sutra. It'll be a certain statement, unargued, but just presented here. I think this. Then, the second step will be quotations directly from Srimad Bhagavatam, generally. Of course, he may also, as he said, he hasn't said yet, I said, that, or when we read through the verse, this verse 27, he says he's also sometimes going to refer to some other scriptures. But mainly, he is then going to present a verse or some verses from Srimad Bhagavatam particularly, which are presenting this idea that he has already mentioned as that introductory statement. Yeah. Then there's a third step, that is a commentary. Then he'll make a commentary. In other words, he'll argue the point and come to a conclusion and establish that point, which he first of all just presented as a statement, like a tadu brahma jigyasa. Now is the time to inquire. Now in the human form of life is the time to inquire into the absolute truth. So then he'd present some verses which basically say that, and then present some arguments. So at the end you agree, yes, right. He has proved to me that now I've come to the human form of life, now is the right time to inquire into the absolute truth. And he says that this, his commentary will be based first and foremost on Sridhar Swami's commentary. Bhavarta Dipika, this famous commentary, that is going to be his main source, primary commentary. So then, also in 27.1, he gives a little description, a little explanation about Sridhar Swami. Sridhar Swami, he says, first of all, is a perfect Vaishnava. Now, it is a fact, though, that when he was living, which was in the 1200s or thereabouts, then Mayavad was so extremely strongly established that it was very widely accepted. And Sridhar Swami's interest, his particular mission was to convert the Mayavadis. That was his business. So when he wrote his commentary on Srimad Bhagavatam, he wrote it with that idea in mind, on that basis. Because, after all, as we mentioned, Shankaracharya wrote that Govindashtakam, which is a very nice glorification of Lord Govinda, Lord Krishna, and is mentioning pastimes which only appear in Srimad Bhagavatam, only in Srimad Bhagavatam. As a result, Shankaracharya, of course, at that time was extremely popular, very overwhelmingly popular, actually. Very, very, very popular indeed. So, having read that Govindashtakam, a certain number of his followers then became interested in Srimad Bhagavatam. As Mayavadis, not really as devotees, but some interest was there. So Sridhar Swami, his strategy was to try to capitalize on that. So he wrote his Bhavarta Dipika, his commentary on Srimad Bhagavatam, in such a way that a Mayavadi audience could take the book. And first of all, of course, it was extremely important that he didn't come on too heavily from the Vaishnava perspective. Because if he just came on just as a straight Vaishnava, then these people who are Mayavadis, actually, they would immediately see this and think, no. This, we're not interested in this, and put it aside. So therefore, he had to couch his presentation in a lot of Mayavad terminology, a certain amount of Mayavad philosophy even, but injected in there was Vaishnavism. This was his strategy. Now, he's a pure devotee, as Jiva Goswami says here, perfect Vaishnava. So when he makes his Vaishnava points, they are just absolutely perfect Vaishnava points. But the problem is, for a Vaishnava at least, the problem for a Vaishnava is you don't want to get caught up in the various Mayavadi points that he also makes as part of his strategy, not because he believes it, but it's part of his strategy. So therefore, Jiva Goswami says, we will cite Sri Swami Charan's commentary verbatim when it agrees with the conclusions of pure Vaishnava philosophy. And when it doesn't, then we won't. Now, of course, in saying that, he is not making some judgment against Sridhar Swami at all. Because, well, he's just said, Sridhar Swami's explanation of the Bhagavatam is our primary source of information for making our points, establishing our points about Krishna consciousness. And we know Lord Chaitanya, he revered Sridhar Swami. He worshipped Sridhar Swami, and he would not tolerate anyone speaking against Sridhar Swami. You know, there's that famous incident where Vallabhacharya, right? Vallabhabhata. He was trying to impress Lord Chaitanya in very mundane ways. So one thing he tried to do is he came along and said, you know, I've written a commentary on Srimad Bhagavatam, and it is better than Sridhar Swami's. I have defeated Sridhar Swami in so many respects, because I forget the exact point that he tried to make, but he made some comment, Sridhar Swami's commentary is too much like this. There's something wrong with it. So now I have corrected everything with my commentary. Can I show you? And Lord Chaitanya's reply was that, what is it? He who criticizes or disobeys the Swami is a prostitute. Yeah. In the sense that a husband can be called Swami by the wife. And if the wife deviates off and becomes involved in other situations, other men, this is prostitution. So, in this way, Lord Chaitanya devastated Vallabhabhatta, completely devastated him. And so, Lord Chaitanya was totally supportive of Sridhar Swami. But of course, there is this understanding, and Jiva Goswami refers to it here. Okay, then, 27 part 2. He says that when we're explaining certain of the Bhagavatam verses, which we're going to be giving as scriptural statements which endorse our initial statement, then sometimes we will explain those verses based on comments that Sridhar Swami has made, but when he's explained other verses, not the particular verse that we're referring to, but where the point is relevant in some other purport of Sridhar Swami for the verse we're commenting on, then we'll take Sridhar Swami's commentary. In other words, he's really going to base it very strongly on Sridhar Swami. But sometimes, he says, sometimes our explanations will be based on the commentaries of the Sri Vaishnavas. However, he qualifies that by saying that the statements down the bottom of the first paragraph there on page 45, the statements of the Sri Vaishnavas, which we are going to quote, will only be those statements which Ramanuja Acharya himself has either made himself personally or has given support to. In other words, there are parts of Sri Vaishnava philosophy which we don't agree with. Yeah. So we're not endorsing the entire scope of Sri Vaishnava philosophy. And of course there are many, you know, the whole history of Sri Vaishnavism is quite long. There are two branches of the Sri Vaishnava Sampradaya right now which disagree with each other. But he'll be accepting certain points either made by Ramanuja himself, or which Ramanuja, if they're made by some other Sri Vaishnava, but they're points which Ramanuja agrees with. And then, at the end of 27 part 2, sometimes we will just explain, where the meaning of the Srimad Bhagavatam verses is just clear, then we'll just explain in following that obvious understanding of the Srimad Bhagavatam verse. So, like this. Okay, so 28. Let's read 28 quickly. 28.1. In this book, I'll be citing various statements from Shruti Puranas and other scriptures, quoting the exact words which I've seen written. I'll do this to provide evidence for my own ideas, rather than to verify what Srimad Bhagavatam says. Sometimes I have not myself seen the original scriptures from which I cite passages. In these cases, these citations I borrow from various works of Sri Madhvacharya Charan, including Sri Bhagavat Tatparya, his commentary on Srimad Bhagavatam, Mahabharat Tatparya, his commentary on Mahabharat, and Brahma Sutra Bhasya, his commentary on Vedanta Sutra. Sri Madhava is the spiritual master of the Tattvavad school. He is an old standard authority. Although he originally belonged to the disciplic line directly descending from Srimad Shankaracharya, he separated himself from Shankara's school and joined the party of the Vaishnavas. His special Vaishnav doctrine has been preached widely. Among his disciples and later followers, renowned in South India and elsewhere, are Sri Vijay Dwaja Tirtha, Brahmanya Tirtha, and Vyasa Tirtha, all of whom are very eminent scholars of the Vedas and their purports. 28.2. Thus, in his Mahabharat Tatparya, his commentary on Mahabharat, Madhva says, "It is by the mercy of the Vedanta Sutra that I have correctly understood other scriptures, having engaged myself in studying many different kinds of books, located in various places. Here I will speak my opinions according to the views of Bhagavan Vyas, the Supreme Lord Narayan, in person, as he has expressed them in his Mahabharat and other works." It is useful to know that Madhvacharya has cited Shruti texts, such as the Chaturvedashika, portions of the Garuda, and other Puranas, which are now not available everywhere. Samhitas like the Mahasamhita, and Tantras like the Tantra Bhagavat and Brahma Tarka. In other words, these books are not available. So the point here is, it's a very interesting point. You know, we've mentioned, it's come up how the Vedic tradition, or the books which make up the Vedic tradition, certain parts have been lost, even considerable parts in the case of the four Vedas. But this, of course, happened over a period of time. It didn't just happen like that. So, just like we read, Jiva Goswami says just a few verses ago that nowadays there are certain Srimad Bhagavatam commentaries readily available to him 450 years ago. But now in 1999, most of them are not available. They're non-existent. So there's been this process of deterioration. Now, going back to the time of Madhvacharya, there were more books available. More of those original old texts and old commentaries on the original texts by different big acharyas and very great authorities. More of them were available then. Anyway, now, first of all, though, Jiva Goswami says in 28.1 that he's going to be quoting many different books, not books, but scriptures, Vedic scriptures, which he has seen. In some cases, some of those books that he saw himself, they're not available today. And for him, 450 years ago, there were also books which were not available to him. But he has seen quotations from them, particularly, he says, in the works of Madhvacharya. Why Madhvacharya? Why not, you know, so many people who may have given quotations from here and there, from previously? The thing about Madhvacharya is that he made an exhaustive research, traveling all over India a number of times, locating old scriptures and getting copies made of them. And in some cases, just reading them and memorizing them and writing them out himself later. So he, in this way, he amassed in Udupi, down in South India, he amassed the biggest library at that time of Vedic literature. Unfortunately, in the meantime, between then and the time of Jiva Goswami, what to speak about now, that library was destroyed. There was a fire. The whole library, or most of the library, was burnt to ashes. So, Madhvacharya wrote about 33 books, which are available now. In those 33 books, he quotes from approximately 200 sources, authoritative sources, which are not available today in 1999. However, of course, we do not doubt Madhvacharya, and neither did Jiva Goswami doubt Madhvacharya. Madhvacharya said that in the Garuda Purana, it says this. So in the Garuda Purana is one of the Puranas which is not fully existing now. So when we go to a copy of Garuda Purana today, we may not find that verse, because that part was lost. But in the time of Madhvacharya, it was existing. So this is the idea. This is the idea here, that he will be referring to two sources in terms of writings of other people, mainly Vedic writings, but then some other commentaries, like he mentions here in 28.2, the Chatur Veda Shika. That is a commentary on the four Vedas. It doesn't say who it's by here. I don't know who it's by. It is a commentary on the four Vedas, which was not existing at the time Jiva Goswami wrote. But Madhvacharya quotes from it. And then various, even Tantra Bhagavat, it appears, was not available at the time of Jiva Goswami, it seems. So you follow the idea here. These are his sources of reference. Jiva Goswami, of course, he was very honest. You know, in a sense that goes without saying for a great acharya. But even before he became a great acharya, Jiva Goswami had a great reputation for being honest, even as a child. As a child, it is said, he would not even dream of anything if it wasn't true. What to speak of speak something if it wasn't true. So he is completely convinced that all these different sources he's going to quote from, that they are genuine, bona fide, authorized, and correct in all respects. You know, of course, at that time, we can also understand he must have had many other possible sources available, which he chose to put aside, though, because they may not have been 100% authorized, even though they were there. So he is sticking to sources which he is completely convinced are valid, even if those sources are not existing exactly at that time. Yeah. So this is his methodology then, and these are his sources. So, any comments or questions? Okay, so we'll go on. Yes? I think he thinks, it would appear at least that he feels it's not required. Otherwise he might go into, you know, because they're big acharyas. Yeah, particularly the audience that he's aiming at. That's another interesting point. Sridhar Swami was aiming at a particular audience, but we know Jiva Goswami is aiming at quite a different audience. Those who have made Lord Krishna the only goal of their lives. That's a very different audience. Yeah. So he's established Srimad Bhagavatam now. It's not exactly that he's going to just get into a whole polemical thing and just argue back and forth and around and about. Not really. He's basically going to follow just a certain line of establishing Krishna consciousness as we know it. He does answer different, you know, objections. Particularly here in Tattva Sandarbha, actually he answers some objections. But as he gets into it more, then, you know, it's not so much like that. It's more just clarifying and explaining in order to establish the points. Yeah, like that. So his audience is such, now he's established Srimad Bhagavatam, his audience is such that, you know, they accept Madhva and Sridhar Swami. Well, Sridhar Swami in those days was universally accepted. He's still accepted amongst the Mayavadis, Sridhar Swami, as a very important commentator after Shankaracharya. Sridhar Swami explained Srimad Bhagavatam. Yeah, that's a fact. But he didn't exactly establish Srimad Bhagavatam. That's what Jiva Goswami's been doing here. He explained it. And now he's established Srimad Bhagavatam, Jiva Goswami. Now, his mode of explanation is going to follow Sridhar Swami's mode of explanation. See, that's to do with the Mayavadis, isn't it? The Mayavadis have become popular in Madhya Pradesh and other places. I guess it's Madhya Pradesh, the middle. It means the middle. Yeah. You know, like the historical kind of fluctuations of fortunes of these different sampradayas and becoming fashionable in one place, going out of fashion somewhere else. I mean, somehow it's like that. Mayavad has become very popular in central India at the time of Jiva Goswami, apparently. Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Now we're going to continue on reading Tattva Sandarbha. We're going to start today the Pramaya section. We've been through the Praman section from verse 1 to 26 or thereabouts. Praman section was establishing, where will we get our knowledge from? What will be our source of knowledge? This Pramaya section is then that now that we've decided what we will get our knowledge from, now Pramaya section means to understand what is the message of that particular book. Yes, we've already decided on that book, Srimad Bhagavatam. So what is the message of that book? What is it trying to convey to us? What is it about? So that is discussed here then from text 29 right to the end, text 63. So the first section is quite a big section. It's about 20 or so, 21 verses or thereabouts. From text 29 to text 49, that is actually the majority of the entire Pramaya section. And that is dedicated to defining the message of Srimad Bhagavatam by considering the realizations of Shukadev Goswami and Vyasadeva. This is a very important point. Srimad Bhagavatam, of course, it's not exactly written by Vyas or written by Shukadev, but it certainly reflects their realizations. Their realizations are consistent with the message of Srimad Bhagavatam. Therefore, they're the ideal speakers, both Vyas and, even more so in a sense, Shukadev. They're both ideal speakers or editors when it comes to Srimad Bhagavatam, because their realizations are perfectly expressed there. Not that Srimad Bhagavatam has now become a vehicle for them to express themselves, but it just so happens that the message of Srimad Bhagavatam and their own messages, their own realizations and perceptions and conceptions of reality are totally, perfectly embodied within Srimad Bhagavatam. It reflects those. So therefore, if we understand the hearts, you could say, the realizations of Shukadev and Vyas, then we have understood the message of Srimad Bhagavatam. So that is going to be discussed then in this section, which is about 20 verses or so long. First of all, in this subsection A, which we're going to try to read through right now, it's actually text 29 to 33, in fact. Sorry, there's a misprint there. Understanding their realizations is from text 29 to text 33. Sorry about that. So this is the first part then, to just get it clear within our minds, what were their realizations, which are then reflected in Srimad Bhagavatam, and which the Srimad Bhagavatam embodies. What are their realizations? And then from 34 onwards till 49, then Jiva Goswami discusses the implications of their realizations in regard to Mayavad philosophy, or just in regard to other conceptions that may be existing. Mayavad, Buddhism, various other ideas were around in those days and were very popular. So from 34 onwards, he's going to discuss then the implications of the realizations of Shukadev and Vyas. Okay, so we're going to try to read through today from 29 to 33. So we'll have to move along a little bit. Let us begin with 29. 29 is expressing the realization of Shukadev. And then 30 to 33 are discussing the realization of Vyas. Okay, so 29, part 1. So now let us look at a verse which offers homage to the speaker of the Srimad Bhagavatam and briefly defines the Bhagavatam's message by reflecting on the attitude of the speaker's heart, where the speaker is really at, what he is all about. So this is then from 12th canto, Srimad Bhagavatam, chapter 12, verse 69. Let me offer my respectful obeisances unto Shukadev Goswami, my spiritual master, the son of Vyasadeva. It is he who defeats all inauspicious things within the universe. Although in the beginning he was absorbed in his own happiness of Brahman realization, giving up all other types of consciousness, he became attracted by the pleasing, most melodious pastimes of Lord Ajita. He therefore mercifully spoke the supreme Purana, Srimad Bhagavatam, which is the bright light of the absolute truth, and which describes the activities of the Lord. So, briefly, well, actually, let us read 29 part 2, because here is Sridhar Swami's commentary on this particular verse. He explains in a very literal way, word by word, word for word. He says that he, Suta Goswami, offers obeisances to his spiritual master, who is Shukadev, of course. Swasuka Nibrita Cheta means he whose heart was full with his own happiness. Therefore he had given up all thoughts of anything else. Even though this was his condition, the gravity of his inner happiness was deflected by the charming pastimes of Lord Ajita. I bow down to him who expounded Srimad Bhagavatam, the light of the truth, that is to say, the scripture which reveals the highest goal of life. So, just by way, the commentary at the end is that we're understanding the message of Srimad Bhagavatam by understanding the heart of its speaker, Shukadev Goswami. So here it's quite clear. He was Brahman realized. That is stated very clearly. And he was completely absorbed in that. He had given up all other types of consciousness. In other words, he was fully spiritually realized, Brahman realized, not just on the way there, or some student of Brahman realization. He was there. He was there in Brahman realization. However, he became attracted by hearing Srimad Bhagavatam. He became attracted by hearing about Krishna. So this implies, obviously, that Krishna consciousness, Krishna katha, is higher, that realization of Krishna is higher than Brahman realization. 29.3. In the same regard, we can examine the three verses in the second canto spoken by Shukadev himself, which begin, "Most sages, O king." Now, Jiva Goswami has not quoted those verses completely. In various other cases, he has completely quoted the verse, so the translation has appeared in the book. But in this case, it doesn't. But we do have the verses here, so we will just now read them for you. Srimad Bhagavatam 2.1, verses 7, 8, and 9. Prayena munayo rajan nivrita vidis shedata nargunya sta ramante sma gunanu katane hare idam bhagavatam nama puranam brahma samitam aditavan dwar parado pitur dwai payanadaham parinishtito pi nargunya utamashloka lilaya grihita cheta rajashe Akyanam Yad Aditavan. O King Parikshit, this is spoken now by Shukadev. O King Parikshit, most topmost transcendentalists, who are above the regulative principles and restrictions, take pleasure in describing the glories of the Lord. At the end of the Dwapara Yuga, I studied this great supplement of Vedic literature, named Srimad Bhagavatam, which is equal to all the Vedas, from my father, Srila Dwaipayana Vyasadeva. O saintly king, I was certainly situated perfectly in transcendence, yet I was still attracted by the delineation of the pastimes of the Lord, who is described by enlightened verses. Therefore I studied this narration. Shukadev Goswami is explaining his own experience. He was perfectly situated in Brahman, but then he heard Srimad Bhagavatam, he became attracted. He became a student of Vyasa and he heard Srimad Bhagavatam from him. That is like an earlier version of that, obviously. Okay. The statement, all inauspicious things in the verse under consideration, Srimad Bhagavatam 12.12.69, we can understand as meaning everything inimical or irrelevant to that mentality. So just go back there to 29.1. It is stated in 29.1, this verse from the 12th canto, that we're offering our obeisances to Shukadev, and he, Shukadev, defeats all inauspicious things. So, to go back to 29.3. Thus this verse indicates that the sambandhi tattva, or in other words, the truth with which one should establish contact, Krishna, is something greater than the bliss of Brahman. It is namely Sriman Ajita, who is especially qualified by his charming pastimes. Yes, that this Lord is fully and literally realized by the name of Krishna is going to be shown in Sri Badarayana Vyasa's trance. The goal of human life, termed Prayojana, is also described here. Here, I think, means... Yeah. Badarayana Vyas is going to express in his trance Prayojana, the goal of life. It is the happiness of pure love for him, Krishna, which produces strong bonding to him. From this can be inferred the abhideya, or process for achieving this goal, specifically the practice of devotional service to him, which generates such pure love for him. The phrase son of Vyas in the verse implies, as we know from the Brahma Vaivarta Purana, that Shukadev was free from all influence of Maya from his very birth, because of Krishna's benediction. The verse under discussion was spoken by Sri Suta to Sri Sonaka, that Srimad Bhagavatam 12.12.69. So of course we don't want to rush it, but the point here is relatively straightforward for the devotees. As we've mentioned, Shukadev was already in trance, already totally realized, and completely free from the influence of Maya, but still he became attracted to Krishna. Realization of Krishna. So this shows, as Jiva Goswami says in 29.3, that the sambandhi tattva, that thing which we should establish relationship with, is something greater than Brahman. It is in fact Ajita, Krishna, who Shukadev became attracted to. And at the end of 29.3, Srila Jiva Goswami refers to a description in Brahma Vaivarta Purana. Prabhupada, in fact, gives that description in one purport in the first canto of Srimad Bhagavatam of how Shukadev Goswami was blessed by Krishna to not fall down from Brahman realization. Probably you know that story. Shukadev was in the womb of the wife of Vyas for 16 years. He was Brahman realized. He felt there was no need to come out, because there was Maya outside and Maya inside his mother's womb, so might as well stay inside. And actually he felt that the Maya outside might be more difficult to deal with than the Maya inside, so he thought, yes, I'll definitely stay inside. However, it was rather uncomfortable for his mother, so his father, Vyas, appealed to him, please come out. And he and Shukadev said, well, I could do, but then I'm going to be exposed to all this Maya. And Vyas said, no, don't worry about it. You're so advanced, you won't fall down. But Shukadev said, well, I don't know whether to believe you. You are motivated. You are a grihasta. You're being influenced by your wife. So, who's feeling uncomfortable here, so you're feeling, you know, some need to try and get me to come out in that way. So I don't trust you, so I'm not coming out. So then Vyas went all the way to Dwarka, it's about 1,000 kilometers away, and got Krishna to come. Krishna came 1,000 kilometers, and he promised Shukadev. He said, I guarantee you won't fall into Maya. So Shukadev came out and ran away. While in his mother's womb, he had already been hearing Srimad Bhagavatam, because Vyas had been teaching it to his students. So he immediately ran away, trying to find Krishna. But then Vyas sent some of his students after him. He told them, just recite verses from Srimad Bhagavatam. And after a while, you'll find that this person will start following you. And then you know, this is the one. Then you just keep reciting Srimad Bhagavatam and come back here. So this is in fact what happened. And then Vyas formally trained Shukadev in Srimad Bhagavatam. And then Shukadev left again. And then later showed up on the banks of the Ganges. So this is all there. Let us go on to verse 30. 30 part 1. It means, Jesus, the name of Krishna, means unconquerable. The Lord who's unconquerable. And Badarayana, I'm not sure exactly what Badarayana means. What's the translation of Badarayana? It's his name. It's one name of his, I know that. Is it? Oh, perhaps that's perhaps true. Huh? Oh, Badri tree. I see. So there's some possible explanations. I'm going to go on to 30 part 1. So that was Shukadev's realization, just briefly described. There's going to be more mention of it in the context of Vyasa's realization. But now, in verse 30, we begin the description of Vyasa's realization. This is very important because it's very vivid. It describes not only his own realization, but, or you could say in the context of his realization, the realities of certain aspects of the absolute truth and different parts like the jivas, the external energy, the internal energy in relation to the absolute truth. Shukadev's realization just shows his own personal experience. But Vyasa's realization, in a sense, has broader implications. Or at least the realization is broader. The same message is also briefly defined in the description of Sri Badarayana's trance. In this meditation, Vyasadeva, the earliest speaker of Srimad Bhagavatam, ascertained the truth, tattva, which was to be propounded in his book he was about to write. So Vyas, as you know, was instructed by Narada that, you know, you're feeling dissatisfied because you haven't described Krishna sufficiently. You've got into Karma Kandya a lot, Vedanta Sutra, which is kind of impersonal like that. So you need to get into Krishna, Krishna Katha more. So what you should do, Narada told him, is you now meditate. And that is in fact going to be mentioned here in these verses. Thus he fixed his mind, Vyas, fixed his mind, perfectly engaging it by linking it in devotional service, bhakti yoga, without any tinge of materialism. And thus he saw the absolute personality of Godhead along with his external energy, which was under his full control. Due to this external energy, the living entity, although transcendental to the three modes of material nature, thinks of himself as a material product and thus undergoes the reactions of material miseries. See, understand this, that Vyas is seeing all of this. He's seeing the Lord, he's seeing the external energy, he is seeing the jivas entangled. Yeah. The material miseries of the living entity, which are superfluous to him, can be directly mitigated by the linking process of devotional service. He's seeing that also. He's seeing it happen. This is realization. But the mass of people do not know this, and therefore the learned Vyasadeva composed this Vedic scripture, Srimad Bhagavatam, which is in relation to the Supreme Truth. Simply by one's giving oral reception to this Vedic scripture,
the feeling for loving devotional service to Lord Krishna, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, sprouts up at once to extinguish the fire of lamentation, illusion, and fearfulness. The great sage Vyasadeva, after composing the Srimad Bhagavatam and revising it, taught it to his son, Sri Shukadev Goswami, who was absorbed in renunciation. Just a detail here, subtle detail. We understand there are 18 Puranas before Vyas compiled Srimad Bhagavatam and taught it to Shukadev, and that which was prior to Shukadev speaking it, which is the version that we have. Yeah. So the previous, there was already a Bhagavat Purana. There were already 18 Puranas. But that Bhagavat Purana was not so Krishna conscious. Therefore Narada told Vyas, you get into Krishna Katha more. So then he went into this trance described here and realized these different things described here. And then he taught it to Shukadev. Then Shukadev spoke it, and that is the version we have, so that other version, the previous version, was replaced. And our version with Shukadev the speaker then became the 18th Purana. So therefore it says here in the last sentence, the great sage Vyasadeva, after composing the Srimad Bhagavatam and revising it. So the revising means, after this, going into trance on the instruction of Narada. That is the revising. That revised version was taught to Shukadeva. He then kind of embellished it or something like that with his own realization. And that version we have. And that previous version from before Narada came to instruct Vyas, that was replaced. 30.2. In that same passage, see these verses here from 1st Canto chapter 7, verse 4 through to verse 11. They're very critical verses in Tattva Sandhava. Because here they're describing very clearly Vyasa's realization. They're also describing some further things about Shukadeva. And that is what is described actually in 30.2. In that same passage, Shonaka asks, Sri Shukadev Goswami was already on the path of self-realization, and thus he was pleased with his own self. We already know that. He was already Brahman realized. So why did he take the trouble to undergo the study of such a vast literature? He was already perfect. Why did he become a student again? He's beyond being a student. To this, Suta Goswami replies, this is now the famous Atmarama verse. All different types of Atmaramas, those who take pleasure in Atma or Spirit Self, especially those established on the path of self-realization, though freed from all kinds of material bondage, desire to render unalloyed devotional service unto the Personality of Godhead. This means that the Lord possesses transcendental qualities and therefore can attract everyone, including liberated souls, including Shukadev. He is the very one being referred to here. Srila Shukadev Goswami, the son of Srila Vyasadeva, was not only transcendentally powerful, he was also very dear to the devotees of the Lord. Thus his mind, captivated by the enchanting qualities of Lord Hari, he underwent the study of this great narration. In other words, he became dear to the devotees when he studied Srimad Bhagavatam. As a Brahmavadi or Brahman realized person, he wasn't really dear to the devotees so much. Well, he was, yeah. But as a devotee, as a student of Srimad Bhagavatam, and after he was a student, he was very dear to the devotees, and the devotees were dear to him. In devotional service, Bhakti Yogena, Srimad Bhagavatam 174, means in pure love of God. This is the conventional meaning of the word as used in the following verse. My dear King, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Mukunda, sometimes grants liberation to those who are engaged in getting in his favor, but he really grants pure bhakti yoga, pure love for him. Yes. Well, you see, the point here is that if you look back at 30, part 1, there are two mentions of bhakti yoga. One is in the first verse there, 174. Bhakti